What wretched life is this I led? Preheated pasta about my head, the stale breadsticks near the vine, upon my bill the overpriced wine. Imitation frittata and curious dip, this bad Italian to burbs I trip. The Olive Garden as I pass, conformist cuisine, it gives me gas. This poem is titled Garden of Last Days. It was found on a suicide note that was discovered by a police inspector, accompanied by the words, Marvel, be glad you're dead. We wish to assure our listeners that this poem has nothing whatsoever to do with Andre Debussy's novel of the same name. We also wish to tell the Olive Garden what bastards they are for not sponsoring this podcast. Okay, so I am here with Andre Debussy, number 3. Is it the third, or can we just call you Andre Debussy now?
Just call me Andre, man.
Okay, Andre, who is here to talk about the Garden of Last Days. Andre, how are you doing?
I'm well. I'm on the road reading from this book, so life is good.
Oh, fantastic. Well, I wanted to ask you a sort of rather large question to open this up. In reading this book, I was reminded very much of Richard Flanagan's The Unknown Terrorist. I'm not sure if you've read that.
I hadn't even heard of that. Somebody was telling me about it.
Yeah.
Like 5 days ago.
Yeah.
So what is this book?
Well, this book is interesting because it has a similar plot line to yours about a stripper who strips and wants to save a good deal of money and unintentionally gets involved with a terrorist
ring. You're kidding me.
Yeah.
Wow.
But I bring this up not to say that, hey, you have pilfered from Mr. Flanagan, who's a great author, but to note that he insisted that this was not a political book.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, he took the template from Heinrich Böll's The Lost Honor of Katharina Blum.
Mm.
And he took the bare bones of that and fashioned a new plot out of this.
Really?
So,
interesting.
So the notion that, say, this book is in some sense a post-9/11 novel almost seems to be kind of folly. I mean, are you comfortable with your book being categorized like this?
Well,
I mean, how do you deal with this notion of, like, you write a book, you finish it, then all of a sudden people want to go ahead and place it into a taxonomy? Is the book someone else's now, or what's the deal?
Yeah, well, you just nailed it, man. I mean, I think when you publish, it's an honor and a privilege, and there are certain costs to go along with it. And one of the costs that go along with having your work made public is people have a right to do whatever the hell they want with it. It's really out of your hands. And do I like it being called a 9/11 novel? No, because I don't think it's just a 9/11 novel. Matter of fact, I wasn't even trying. It's hard to believe if you read the book. It's hard to believe I would say this, but I actually wasn't trying to write about 9/11. Matter of fact, I was trying not to write about 9/11.
Yeah.
I was just trying to be these people on the periphery of it. And then the character came in, of course, one of the young Saudi men who's much more involved than on the periphery of it. But I'm with you. I prefer it not to be reduced or put in a category, but writers don't have even a right to complain about that. I mean, people will put your books where they're going to put them. It's a privilege to publish them.
But there is this notion, I think, that the 9/11 is the card that you play if you want to have a serious contemporary novel these days. And here we are.
That's interesting.
7 years after it, and people can't stop classifying books as post-9/11 or 9/11 books. I mean, when do we shake off the stigma, I wonder?
Yeah, because you know what? I think it has become a stigma because, you know, I wouldn't even call it a card to play. I mean, maybe, but it seems to me that a lot of the books that have been written that try to deal with 9/11 in some honest way have been sort of written off or accused of not even coming close to capturing it. And maybe, Ed, maybe that was one of the reasons why I actually resisted even taking on this subject. It's just so large, still a psychic wound in our culture.
Yeah.
And maybe we're not ready to face it. But back to your thought about political novels and this man, Richard Flanagan, whose work I look forward to reading. I purposely try not to be political either or say anything political. I've learned over the years, though, that if I just go deeply enough into story and character and try to write as honestly as I possibly can, that novel or story is going to say a lot more than any smart writer could ever come up with.
Yeah. Well, one could also look at the frequent cars in this book and say, oh, well, this is almost an American road novel in some sense.
There are a lot of cars in that book, yeah.
There are a lot of cars, but I wanted to bring this up.
And trucks.
And trucks. But I wanted to bring this up because I know that in the interview you did with Robert Birnbaum, you told him that you did a lot of your writing in cars.
Mm.
And Tobias Wolff suggested to me when I pointed out the same thing, like, hey, you write a lot of stories set in cars, that he viewed the car as this great American confessional experience. And so I want to sort of discern from you exactly why the cars have
found their way so frequently in this particular novel. Is it that common confessional, that shared experience of staring straight ahead in the road and exchanging your intimate moments, or is it really more the setting of 2 days in this particular book, or is there some kind of transposition of your writing process, which is possibly still scrabbling on, yeah, onto, yeah, onto napkins?
Well, I got to tell you, I wrote a lot of this novel in my future master bathroom near the hole in the floor that will one day hold a toilet. So I don't want to get scatological. Yeah. You know, for me, you know, it's a great question because I haven't thought about consciously cars in this novel. There are a lot of cars, especially the character of AJ and his Ford F-150. Honestly, I got to say, man, when I think back on it, that it's really less about confessionals. I love what Tobias Wolff said about that, but it's more about isolation.
Mm-hmm.
Everyone's very alone in their cars, and they're going very fast away from everybody else, and they're kind of cruising and brooding, and in some cases even drinking while driving and brooding some more. And to me, it may be a metaphor of how we're on the move and we're all so damn alone.
Mm-hmm. I'm wondering, though, if writing in particular settings causes you to dwell upon them. Little subconscious acts of writing become conscious locations in the actual book that you're working on. Does this frequently happen? Are you aware of this? Or do you just not even worry about something like this?
About what? About the...
About, like, the notion of, like, say, oh, you're writing something in a car, and then the car itself
becomes
sticks
part
into
of the
your
story.
Subconscious and then becomes part of the story, yes.
I don't consciously think about it because I found that if I do get self-conscious about it, then maybe I'll stop something from happening that should happen.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a really cool alchemy. You know, in The Garden of Last Days, one of the characters, AJ, is an excavator who used to manage a drugstore. And when I was writing this book, I was also building my family home as the carpenter, and I got to run the excavating machine, and my excavator was actually a guy who used to run a store.
Mm-hmm.
And before I know it, my character is an excavator who used to run a store. So this shit happens all the time.
Yeah. I know you draw from experience like this. You had a life in your 20s in which you worked a number of blue-collar jobs and the like. Mm. You also have said in other interviews that you clip items from newspapers and the like to sort of get inspiration. But I'm wondering where the inventive nature of writing comes in for you. I mean, to what degree do you invent, or is it just a natural process of essentially building off or reacting in some sense from a pre-existing story or a pre-existing narrative or a pre-existing anecdote some guy is telling you?
Well, you know, I think you put that very well. I think it's a combination. You know, the writer Flannery O'Connor, in her essay The Nature and Name of Fiction, has a great line. She says, a writer's beliefs are not what she sees, but the light by which she sees. Right? So what we believe, what we've been through, what shaped us is really part of what creates our vision. And I think it's important to stand conscious about all of that, because I truly believe, especially with fiction writing, this is all the dream world, right? It's the dream world we're pulling it from. It's the dream that we're trying to cast over the reader.
Mm-hmm.
And I try to stay unconscious about that so it stays more of a dream than a thinking experience.
But it's a very realist dream, I would think.
I mean,
there isn't a lot of trickery in this book, in the sense of you're pretty much telling these people's stories. So I guess in what sense is it really a dream, and in what sense is it a kind of verisimilitudinous representation of our world?
Yeah, yeah. And also, especially in this book, where one of the characters is a composite of real men in our recent history who did real things, which also kind of locks you into a certain parameter. But you know what I like about that locking in? The director, Mike Nichols, had a great line about that. He was asked in an interview, so what's the main question the storyteller asks before he or she begins the story? And he said, Nichols did, well, it's not the same thing a newspaper reporter asks. The first thing a newspaper reporter asks is, what happened?
Mm-hmm.
What the storyteller asks is, what's it like? What's it really like to be in this thing that's happened?
But to what degree do you really know what it's really like? Because you are not a woman.
That's right.
You are a white man. And
right.
So therefore, when you're writing about an outsider in both this book and House of Sand and Fog, it's not exactly something that you could entirely tap, although you can get an approximation of that.
Yeah, you're right. And how do we know how close we ever come? I'll tell you, though, I have a strong faith in the imagination. Not necessarily my imagination, but the imagination we all get at birth. And I think If you go very deeply, if we go very deeply into each of our imaginations, I really believe that down there deep is the knowledge of the other. Mm-hmm. It's not even the knowledge of the other, but an experience of the other. Mm-hmm. You know, and also, let's not forget how much you can translate certain experiences. My first published story was a story called Forky, from the point of view of an inmate out on a date for the first time in 7 years after being in the pen. I got some nice letters from inmates wanting to know where I did time. It was all very encouraging. But I realized what they were reading possibly that rang with us, the authenticity. I'm really sounding like I'm patting myself on the back now, but I'm trying to make an artistic point. I'd never done time in prison. Matter of fact, I'd never stepped foot in a prison when I wrote that story. But I had been a new kid in school 14 times. I knew what it was like to step inside a hostile schoolyard. So it's not a huge leap of the imagination to imagine stepping into a prison yard facing a raping or a knifing instead of a beating. So that's there too.
That's true. But in approximation of a personal experience, I mean, how does this translate into conveying the true nature of what it is to strip for money and to constantly long for the money? Obviously, there's the financial angle that I suppose would be a common ground, mm-hmm. but then there is also this notion of being viewed upon objectively, and in some cases, like the nightclub owner, Lewis, looked at as this capitalist object, essentially.
Exactly. Women are objects in that business. That's right.
Yeah. But I mean, how do you tap into that if you're only looking at it from a tertiary standpoint?
Well, I try not to have it be tertiary. I think you're right in looking at it in this way, but, you know, if nothing else, over the years writing fiction, I've come to the conclusion that other experiences are knowable by other people. And I honestly, I don't know if I would even try to write character-driven fiction if I didn't believe that. I think that writing fiction is an act of sustained act of empathy, mm-hmm. you know, of asking yourself, what's it like to be you? You know, the poet William Stafford said it beautifully in a short essay about writing poems. He said, the poet has to get him or herself into a state of receptivity or openness or non-judgment. Hemingway would say, he said, the job of the writer is not to judge, but to seek to understand. All of this, I think that if you do that, combined with a very sincere grappling with the tools that are available to the writer, you know, active verbs and precise word choice, all that stuff, that you can pull what's inside you out. And surprisingly, and this is another thing that I think is really exciting, surprisingly, we find we have far more in common than not.
Is it really the prose itself that allows you that entry point? Like, for example, in this book and in much of your work, you are very fond, when you're setting up a location, of having these serial items in your sentence, basically commas, phrase, you know, like that. And I'm wondering how this came about, that this slightly fragmented approach to viewing a reality is really the way to tap into it.
That is an amazing insight you just had about that. This is news to me. What do I do?
Well, that you essentially set up like, okay, we're going into like the beginning of a chapter or the beginning of a scene in one of your books. Mm-hmm. And what you do is you do a sort of standard declarative sentence where you do, you know, subject verb, like he gunned down the highway, comma, you describe the highway, comma, something else that evokes and modifies mm-hmm. upon the previous declarative sentence that you
Well,
do.
You know, thank you for being specific about that. Yeah, you know why? Because I'm trying to do this sort of tawdry thing, some writers and maybe readers would say, of getting the reader to forget he or she is reading. Mm. So I want to first signify, now you're this guy in his point of view, now you're in his truck, and now look what's out the window, and look what's between your legs, a cold beer, and listen to what's on the radio, and listen to what he's thinking about. And I work very hard to cast you in a spell, mm-hmm. And then to go from there. But I first want to get you in, and I don't want to leave you out at all. I find, by the way, that I'm very intolerant of other kinds of, not fiction other than mine, but I'm a sucker for realism and naturalism. And I find that other kinds of fiction is, it's difficult for me to appreciate, and it's my failing. I don't think there's anything wrong with metafiction or very wordy abstract fiction, but oftentimes I feel as if the reader is the last one being considered, and that's the first one I'm always trying to consider. I'm not saying I succeed at this, but I'm always trying to.
But I'm wondering if one can lock into a rather foreign voice, a postmodernistic voice, or say a really, I suppose, encyclopedic prodigious fiction voice, like say Richard Powers or William mm-hmm. T. Volman or something like mm-hmm. that, and still be caught up in the actual language. And I'm not certain if it's really a matter of realism all the time, as it is a matter of the text serving as this prism between reader and author that involves a shared perspective. Because essentially what you're doing, in addition to reality, is also offering your particular view of the world.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. I don't know what to say to that.
Well, I'm wondering, you know, this notion of, say, something that is more anti-real or magical realism or postmodern, what is it about this that does not work for you? Have you made any efforts in your fiction writing to try to approximate that?
No, but it's on my list of things to do creatively, to try more of a mess with the fourth wall thing that these postmodernists have done. But the truth is, this postmodern stuff leaves me so cold and so often actually pisses me off.
Really?
I feel jerked around, but, you know, and look, this is where I sound like the redneck that I am. I mean it. You know, I also a lot of modern art ticks me off. You know, I'm one of these guys who goes into a modern art museum. I'm not saying it's all ticking me off. Some is quite brilliant and affecting. But, you know, I once went to an exhibit in the 80s, and there was a manhole cover with a dog turd on it and plexiglass covering it, and the guy called it art, and it just made me mad. You know, and some of that, I think, happens with language. I think it's very easy to be self-indulgent as a writer. I don't know. I'm old-fashioned. I'm not a postmodernist. I think I'm probably a modernist.
Yeah, I would agree.
Yeah,
but
I go back 100 years.
At the same time, one could also argue that all writing is self-indulgent in some sense. You are putting your will, your story, onto the page. So maybe it's not necessarily a fair criticism on your part.
Yeah, I'm willing to hear that. Well, yeah, however, I will say this as a defense of my view here. Yes, but. Here's the but. And again, I don't want to single anyone out, and everyone's got a right to create any way they want, and certainly there are people out there who like all kinds of work. And I actually wish I had a broader appreciation of this stuff. But by self-indulgent, I mean... thank you. It's not me. I actually think that I like what Blaise Pascal said, right? The French philosopher, inventor of 16th century, said, anything written to please the author is worthless. Hmm. Now, what I love about that is you don't even get to please yourself. That ultimately what you should be trying to please is, and ultimately you shouldn't even be trying to please the reader the most either. Mm-hmm. You should be trying to please it, the thing that's coming out of you. And in my case, I try to write character-driven fiction. So what I'm trying to please is the truth of the character. I'm trying to write as honest. I'm not saying I succeed at this, but my task constantly feels like this. Is this really what she said? Does he really think this? Would he really do this? And if my, as Hemingway said, if my shockproof built-in shit detector doesn't go off, then I keep writing.
Is this why it takes you so long to turn out a book?
Yeah, yeah. Although I should say, you know, it hasn't been, that didn't take 9 years. The Garden of Last Days took 5. I wrote one after House in a Fog that is still not working. This novel I've been trying to write for 25 years, and I'm still going to get back to it. But yeah, I'm slow, and that's probably one reason why. I'm working really hard to write with character and only that.
Hmm. I wanted to ask you, this is a totally different subject, but I had to remark upon the beverage motif throughout this book. We open this book with, of course, April having a plastic coffee cup between her legs. And then 200, 300 pages in, we see the cop with the number one granddad mug. And then we also have Virginia heating a warm, cold cup of coffee in the microwave.
This is brilliant, man.
No, but I mean, but the concern for coffee in this is rather extraordinary, because coffee is almost this life force of good versus the drinking that one sees from the antagonists in this book. All the antagonists tend to drink, or they resist drink in order to be good. And so
this is fascinating.
Kind of coffee alcohol axis I had to ask you about.
Well, God, that just sounds like a weekend in my life. You know, drink on Friday, drink Friday night, drink coffee on Saturday morning. Fascinating. Wow, I hadn't even known that. Listen, I do believe that we live in our bodies, even those of us who seem to live, you know, very ethereally from the chin up. And I truly believe that these sensual details shape us and guide us. You know, I had this experience a few years ago where my wife and I had a little spat over money first thing in the morning. My coffee was cold, gone cold during the fight. I get in the car, it hardly starts up, and I'm worried about money and can I fix this clutch. I drive off, a guy cuts me off in his truck, and I'm telling you, if that car could go fast, I'd go down the road, rip him out of his truck, and beat on him. The next day, you know, my wife and I were fine. We weren't having a spat. My coffee was delicious. It was a perfect cup of dark French roast, black, that I like, and it was just the right temperature. I had a little cup, driving cup, and it wasn't spilling. The car started up. I pull out in the road. Another guy cuts me off. Mm-hmm. And this time, Ed, I said, go in peace, my brother. You should be careful. You might hurt someone or yourself. I had all this goodwill, and it had to do with my coffee being good.
But I'm wondering how this
stuff isn't unimportant.
Yeah, yeah. But it's important, but I'm curious as to how you have to be aware of, since there is so much coffee in this book, that you're repeating this symbol over and over again. So the readers like me say, oh, well, coffee might be a symbol. Or, you know, as we're sort of suggesting here, it may not even be a symbol at all. It may just be some aspect of the world that you're drawing from
that
happens to repeat itself.
No, but Ed, man, I really believe the reader tends to know more than the writer, at least certainly in my case. You know, the fact that you see that as symbolic means it probably is. But just because I, the writer of that book, don't see it that way or haven't considered it that way doesn't mean that's not the case. You know, I try to do all this from the dream world, right? I try to dream these novels out. And that's not to say I don't revise constantly and give it good hard thought in the revision process. But the first draft is a dream thing. And I had a conversation with a woman just recently. She said, so you don't outline your stories? I said, no. So you just go from scene to scene? Yeah. And she said, so then the reader is the interpreter of your dreams.
Mm-hmm.
I said, yeah.
Mm.
The readers and maybe the critics are dream interpreters. Yeah. And so I think you interpreted something that sounds valid to me, but it's news to me, too.
Yeah.
But that just means hasn't been conscious for me.
I'm wondering if this notion of establishing a dream world and also this notion of what you were telling me earlier about trying to find the truth in character, this is why you needed to set a good chunk of this book within a two-day period. Because within that, you have this real sustained rush and you're able, I suppose, to organize all the details in a way that you can't necessarily do if you're taking, you know, 6 months to tell a story or six
right.
months in the novel to tell the story.
Right.
Are there advantages to working within these confined narratives? I mean, I think also of like Richard Ford's fiction, which is always better when he has, you know, long days to actually play around with.
I think that's a great point. I think that's true. I think that, you know, I really use essential details as guides. You know, Richard Bausch has a great line. No, actually, Ron Carlson said this. That he said, details are for the writer only. They are the instruments by which we steer. Right? So I think you're onto something there. I actually use them to guide the ship, to actually find the story and then write it. I also end up cutting a lot, too. I mean, this novel was 250 pages longer than the one you're reading. And so I tend to overwrite in order to find the thing, then shave it back down. But I also enjoy writing over long periods of time. You know, I've got a couple of novellas that I've finished, and I'm working on another one where it does cover months and years of a character's life. But I find that I still write very sensually, where I'll give you concrete, specific sensual scenes that are essential and say something, and then move ahead 6 weeks or whatever in that way.
I'm curious why the short sustained bursts of these chapters, this is part of the process, because in this case, you're going from, in House of Sand and Fog, you have alternating first-person perspectives to rather close third-person perspectives. Like, for example, AJ, one thing that I was amused by was the fact that you italicize specific words every time he shows up, and how a tick like this occurs in the text. This I wanted to ask you, and I also wanted to ask about the other question, but two questions kind of merged into one, so perhaps you could tackle them both in one or two answers.
So what's the question, though?
The question is if you are confining yourself to a two-day narrative, how is this why you write in short sustained
yes.
bursts?
Yep, exactly. I think it became clear, you know, pretty early on in the writing of this story that, first of all, it wasn't going to be a short story, which I thought it was going to be. I thought it was just going to focus on a woman who danced for one of these men, and that was it. But it kept growing. And one thing led to another. And I think the reader needs a break. You know, if it's kind of, you know, you're kind of stuck in this dark, you know, clubs are claustrophobic. You know, strip clubs are like casinos. There are no windows, and the doors are hidden. And yeah, I thought the reader needed a break, but I also needed to get out of the heads of various characters into the heads of others, and that seemed to be the form for this thing, and so I allowed it.
Is it a matter of the claustrophobia of the Puma Club affecting you as a writer, that you can only go into this territory for a certain amount of time before you need to go back out?
Yeah,
of it? Or is it a case of ADD on your part, or what?
Almost. It was more claustrophobia, you know. I can't tell you how glad I was. You know, I try to work very intuitively and instinctively, and the character of AJ, so this guy gets kicked out of the club, and he's, you know, he just looked like a character from my point of view who was seen by another character. And then I feel him out there in the club. I just feel him kind of pulsing out there in the club. And, man, my gut said, well, go check in with this guy. And now I'm sitting in the truck with this spurned, little drunk, angry young man, and didn't see him coming at all. And part of me was relieved just to get the hell out of the club. So I sat in the truck with him a while, had a beer with him. And then began to see his strange machinations.
Which is interesting because there's a moral outrage towards the club from his character, which I find
that isn't that interesting? Yeah. So it gave me a chance to vent. Look at these poor losers. And then here we are, AJ and I riding down the highway.
Well, Lonnie has a very intriguing books on tape situation in which he listens to The Wasteland on tape. And this seemed to me almost kind of a statement about America's relationship with literacy. He's the only person, the only character who is willing to listen to this particular tape, and I'm wondering if again, you're letting off steam from the club. Is this your way of, I guess, accessing some literary part of you to kind of at least get that part flourishing in this particular character?
Yeah, but I'll tell you, man, I just really love the careful way you're reading this novel, Ed. I mean, it's really, these are great points, most of which are news to me, which is not to say they're not there. Mm-hmm. Was I conscious of using The Wasteland and T.S. Eliot to make a point? No. But it instinctively felt right to go farther away from a non-reading character like April or AJ, for example, and certainly Bassam, who only reads the Quran, to it just, you know, look, there's something, this may sound pretentious, but I don't care because I think of this all the time. Sometimes when I'm writing a novel, and I've written four or five and published three of those, I feel like a conductor of a symphony. And I know very little about classical music, but I really admire it and like most of what I hear. And where there's a string section and a horn section and percussions and woodwinds, and what I love about the novel as a form is it's symphonic, that it can hold so many sections and so many different kinds of sounds and still work. So there was a feeling.
Yes. May I help you with something, sir?
Oh, we're gonna be like done in about maybe five.
I don't know nothing about it. Nobody don't know.
Oh, I'm sorry. A gentleman gave us permission to come in.
We're not entirely certain why, but it seems that a catering manager took offense to the fact that we were recording a conversation in this hotel. What follows is a brief pause, but we shall return to the conversation in question.
Okay, so
you should put that in your. So where were we, brother?
We were talking about, I think, this. You were talking about you being a conductor. But actually, we could go off of that cliche answer into another territory. You had said earlier that you were not a political writer. And yet, inarguably, there are a number of political or social issues within this book. I think particularly of healthcare in this. You have the older woman who leaves the hospital, and she has to actually, the people inform her that, well, your insurance won't cover this. Likewise, with AJ and his injuries, he is reluctant to go to a hospital. And this almost seemed part of the problem of these characters, that America was kind of crushing in on them. So I don't entirely believe that's a non-apolitical move on your part.
Well, that no, seems... I mean, well, but I gotta say, though, yes. Let me tell you, man, you know, as just a human being out in the world and a citizen of our society, you know, I'm a political animal. I have my political philosophies and beliefs and my angers and resentments and passions. But I try to keep all this subconscious when I'm writing. Mm-hmm. And, yeah, there's the man against the machine, the woman against the bureaucracy that goes on here. And I saw a lot of that in House of Sand and Fog. And in my first novel, Blues Man, there's all kinds of Marxism and anti-war stuff. You know, I got an undergraduate degree in sociology and political science.
Yeah.
And I was heading towards what I thought was going to be a career in politics. And why the hell was I interested in politics? I wanted to fight for social change. I wanted to somehow fight social injustices wherever they appeared, in whatever form. I was a very idealistic, passionate young guy. And then I found writing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, back to that O'Connor line about a writer's beliefs being the light by which he sees. There you go. I think everything that you say is in there, but I was not consciously injecting it.
Then what responsibility do you have as a novelist? That's the question.
I think the responsibility the novelist has is just one big one. To be honest. Mm-hmm. And to write as truly as you possibly can. Okay, here's one thing I find myself saying in writing classes a lot. I think there's a difference between making something up and imagining it. Right? A friend of mine went to a party 25 years ago before I started writing fiction, and there's a writer we really admired there, and she said we read, you know, how much she really loved his first novel. She wants to see his second one. He said, don't read, it's a piece of crap. Mm-hmm. She said, how can you say that? He said, well, it was going all right, but you know, I was 2 years late with a deadline, I needed the money, I made up the ending and gave it to the publisher. Mm-hmm. So at the time I didn't understand what she meant. I said, well, he made up the whole thing, right? It's a novel. Well, you know what he meant. He imposed an ending on it that was not organic, that didn't come from it. So look, so what's the opposite? The opposite is imagining it, where you're not sitting around making up a story, but you're trying to find the story, and you're trying to find it as honestly as you can, and you're using every tool you have available to you to try to write it as truly as you can. Again, I go to O'Connor, man, and she said the job of the writer is simply to make actual the mystery of our position on Earth. I think that's the job of the novelist. It's a central job of the novelist, to try to capture some kind of human truth. And they don't have to be big truths. They don't have to be truths about war and peace and love and death. However, if you go deeply into human beings, those things will come up.
Yeah.
And I hate to sound as if, you know, writing is just this thing where you just gush out a story and it's all up to you guys. But on some level, I think that's the case.
Yeah, yeah. But I'm also wondering, though, because a novelist is essentially a professional liar. I mean, this has been said over and over and over of writers in general. I mean, is it really truthful? Is it really a matter of prevaricating? I mean, and going back to what you were saying earlier about your bullshit detector going off in relation to conceptual snafus and the like, I mean, it seems to me that there may also be certain limitations that you're trying to push beyond in capturing this particular truth. So how is it a pack of lies, and how is it a truth, and what limits are you imposing upon yourself here?
Yeah, man, you get a PhD in that question. I like what Picasso said, right? You know, art is one great big lie that tells a greater truth.
Yeah. He also said that it was 99% plagiarism, too.
Did he really?
Something like that.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably true, too. You know, I'm really fascinated by this whole notion of facts versus truth, right? You and I could be brothers. We could think about a bad Halloween night, and I guarantee you five other people from our family, we could all be sitting around talking about this bad Halloween, and we are all going to have completely different versions of this night, and we're all going to be willing to fight over our versions. No, I was there. These are the facts. Mm-hmm. Well, no. There's what you perceive, and there's what she perceives, and then there's somehow in between the two, the truth. One of the things I feel strongly is that truth is so elusive. You know, it's like, I don't know. It's like goodness and evil. It's like right and wrong. These are hard to find in a pure form, and so is truth. But I don't. It's interesting. I don't think that. I wouldn't call fiction lying. Not the kind that I like to read and the kind I try to write. I would call some of it lying. Mm-hmm. And again, back to what we said earlier, there is some fiction that I feel is... and do you know what it comes down to? Sincerity. Mm-hmm. Sincerity isn't enough. But Nadine Gordimer has a line, one of her characters has a line in Nadine Gordimer's novel, A Sun Story, where the woman says, sincerity... She occurs to her what sincerity is. Sincerity is never having an idea about oneself. Mm-hmm. All right, so back to this notion of self-indulgence. I truly believe that it is possible to illuminate real truths. Yeah, you may be coming up with people that don't exist in this world, but how can we say they're not real? How can we say that Tom Joad and the Joad family don't exist? How can we say Hamlet doesn't exist? You know, how can we say, you know, Biff from Arthur Miller's great play doesn't exist? They become actually more true than real people. So I just love all this stuff. It's mysterious as hell, too.
Certainly. One last question I have to ask you about, and that is the absence of fathers and husbands in this.
Yeah.
I mean, Jean doesn't have her husband. April is now on her own. And, in fact, it's very interesting how her story ends up near the end of the book. And, likewise, you have AJ, who is prevented by societal constructs and restraining orders and the like from actually being part of a family unit. And what's interesting about him is that he goes to his job site in order to find some kind of identity, almost as if his vocation is his being, but his family is not his being. But this was very intriguing to me, this
idea. And Bassam's got a problem with his father.
That's exactly it. I could offer a rather hackneyed observation, but why the concern for fathers and husbands and the absence of them? Is this just something that you really have dwelled upon in the last 5 years?
I don't know if it's something I've dwelled upon, but it's certainly a wound I carry, you know, and I don't want to get too psychological, because I do think, too, that the deeper a writer or any sort of creative person goes in whatever form it is, we actually move beyond our own personal life experience into something more universal that we may never have lived. But, you know, I am a husband. I am a father, I'm happy to say. And, you know, I'm in a solid 20-year marriage so far. And I'm there for my kids. We live in the same house. I don't have a broken home, but I came from a broken home as a kid. Mm-hmm. And when I look back at a lot of my fiction, there are a lot of rifts in these families. There's not one that isn't a little broken or a lot broken. One of the things I found that I was wrestling with in this novel, and again to show that I don't completely not think what I'm writing, is that one of the things, themes that I was exploring was this notion of aimless, drifting young men. And masculinity sort of untamed, and how fatherhood and husbandhood tames it. And then what happens when you're set free from those roles or you're cast out of those roles? It kind of gets wild again.
Yeah. But there's this notion of patriarchy as almost a kind of solving point to some degree for these characters and even for the woman. And that's why I'm fascinated by the fact that it is the gaping cavity for every particular character almost.
Huh.
You know.
Are you suggesting I'm patriarchal?
No. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with this, but I'm just kind of curious to
It's interesting. It's as if patriarchy is a vacuum, that there's the hint of it, but it's not there, and if it showed up, it wouldn't work. I do know that AJ is a traditional man in a lot of ways, and Bassam, of course, is dangerous in his traditions that have been perverted. I don't know. I think you're onto something there, man. You're onto something.
Okay. Well, with that thought, Andre, it was a pleasure chatting with you. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure chatting with you.
All right. I never promised you a rose garden along with the sunshine. There's gotta be a little rain sometimes. When you take, you gotta give. So live, let live, or let go. Oh, 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 I beg your pardon. I never promised you a rose garden. I could promise you things like